The Lovely Bones, Disc 6.
Grandma Lin arrived on the Monday before Thanksgiving. With the same laser beam eyes that immediately sought out any unsightly blemish on my sister, she now saw something beneath the surface of her daughter's smile. In her placated, tranquilized movements, and in how her body responded whenever Detective Fennerman or the police work came up. When my mother refused my father's help in cleaning up after dinner that night, the laser eyes were certain. Adamantly, and to the shock of everyone at the table and the relief of my sister, Grandma Lin made an announcement. "Abigail, I'm going to help you clean up. It will be a mother-daughter thing." "What?" My mother had calculated that she could let Lindsay off easily and early, and then she would spend the rest of the night over the sink, washing slowly and staring out the window until the darkness brought her own reflection back to her. The sounds of the TV would fade away, and she would be alone again. "I just did my nails yesterday," Grandma Lin said after tying on an apron over her camel-colored A-line dress. "So I'll dry."
"Mother, really, this isn't necessary."
"It is necessary. Believe me, sweetie," my grandmother said. There was something sober and curt in that "sweetie." Buckley led my father by the hand into the adjoining room where the TV sat. They took up their stations, and Lindsay, having been given a reprieve, went upstairs to call Samuel. It was such a strange thing to see. So out of the ordinary, my grandmother in an apron, holding a dish towel up like a matador's red flag in anticipation of the first dish coming her way. They were quiet as they worked, and the silence, the only sounds being the splash of my mother's hands plunging into the scalding water, the squeak of plates, and the clank of the silver, made a tension fill the room which grew unbearable. The noises of the game from the nearby room were just as odd to me. My father had never watched football, basketball, his only sport. Grandma Lin had never done dishes. Frozen meals and takeout menus were her weapons of choice.
"Oh, Christ," she finally said. "Take this."
She handed the just-washed dish back to my mother. "I want to have a real conversation, but I'm afraid I'm going to drop these things. Let's take a walk."
"Mother, I need to..."
"You need to take a walk.
After the dishes."
"Listen," my grandmother said. "I know I'm whatever I am, and you're whatever you are, which isn't me, which makes you happy. But I know some things when I see them, and I know something is going on that isn't kosher. Capiche?"
My mother's face was wavering, soft and malleable, almost as soft and malleable as the image of her that floated on the sullied water in the sink.
"What?" "I have suspicions, and I don't want to talk about them here." 10-4, Grandma Lin, I thought. I'd never seen her nervous before. It would be easy for the two of them to leave the house alone. My father, with his knee, would never think to join them. And these days, where my father went or didn't go, my brother, Buckley, followed. My mother was silent. She saw no other option. As an afterthought, they removed their aprons in the garage and piled them on the roof of the Mustang. My mother bent down and lifted the garage door. It was still early enough so the light would hold for the beginning of their walk. "We could take holiday," my mother tried.
"Just you and your mother,"
my grandmother said. "The most frightening pairing imaginable." They had never been close. They both knew it, but it wasn't something they acknowledged very much. They joked around it like two children who didn't particularly like each other, but were the only children in a large, barren neighborhood. Now, never having tried to before, having always let her daughter run as fast as she could in whatever direction she wished, my grandmother found that she was suddenly catching up. They had passed by the O'Dwyers and were near the Tarkings,
before my grandmother said what she had to say.
My humor buried my acceptance, my grandmother said. Your father had a long-term affair in New Hampshire. Her first initial was F, and I never knew what it stood for. I found 1,000 options for it over the years.
Mother?
My grandmother kept walking, didn't turn. She found that the crisp fall air helped, filling her lungs until they felt cleaner than they had just minutes before.
Did you know that?
No.
I guess I never told you, she said. I didn't think you needed to know.
Now you do, don't you think? I'm not sure why you're telling me this. They had come to the bend in the road that would lead them back around the circle. If they went that way and didn't stop, eventually they would find themselves in front of Mr. Harvey's house. My mother froze.
My poor, poor sweetie,
my grandmother said.
Give me your hand.
They were awkward. My mother could count on her fingers how many times her tall father had leaned down and kissed her as a child. The scratchy beard that smelled of a cologne that, after years of searching, she could never identify. My grandmother took her hand and held on as they walked the other way. They walked into an area of the neighborhood where newer families seemed to be moving in more and more. The anchor houses, I remembered my mother calling them, because they lined the street that led into the whole development, anchored the neighborhood to an original road built before the township was a township. The road that led to Valley Forge, to George Washington and the Revolution.
Susie's death brought your father's back to me,
my grandmother said.
I never let myself mourn him properly.
I know, my mother said.
Do you resent me for it?
My mother paused. Yes. My grandmother patted the back of my mother's hand with her free one.
Good.
See? That's a nugget.
A nugget?
Something that's coming out of all this. You and me. A nugget of truth between us.
They passed the 1-acre lots on which trees had been growing for 20 years. If not exactly towering, they were still twice as tall as the fathers who had first held them and stomped the dirt around them with their weekend work shoes.
Do you know how alone I've always felt?
My mother asked her mother.
That's why we're walking, Abigail,
Grandma Lynn said. My mother focused her eyes in front of her, but stayed connected to her mother with her hand. She thought of the solitary nature of her childhood. How, when she had watched her 2 daughters tie string between paper cups and go to separate rooms to whisper secrets to each other, she couldn't really say she knew how that felt. There had been no one else in the house with her, but her mother and father. And then her father had gone. She stared at the tops of the trees, which miles from our development were the tallest things around. They stood on a high hill that had never been cleared for houses, and on which a few old farmers still dwelled.
I can't describe what I'm feeling, she said, to anyone.
They reached the end of the development just as the sun was going down over the hill in front of them. A moment passed without either of them turning around. My mother watched the last light flicker in a drain-off puddle at the end of the road.
I don't know what to do, she said. It's all over now.
My grandmother wasn't sure what she meant by it, but she didn't press harder.
Shall we head back?
My grandmother offered.
How?
My mother said.
To the house, Abigail. Head back to the house.
They turned and began walking again. The houses, one after another, identical in structure. Only what my grandmother thought of as their accessories marked them as different. She had never understood places like this, places where her own child had chosen to live.
When we get to the turn to the circle, my mother said. I want to walk past it.
His house?
Yes.
I watched Grandma Lynn turn when my mother turned.
Would you promise me not to see the man anymore?
My grandmother asked.
Who?
The man you're involved with. That's what I've been talking about.
I'm not involved with anyone, my mother said.
Her mind flew like a bird from one rooftop to the next.
Mother,
she said, and turned.
Abigail? If I needed to get away for a while, could I use Daddy's cabin?
Have you been listening to me? They could smell something in the air, and again my mother's anxious, agile mind slipped away.
Someone is smoking, she said.
Grandma Lynn was staring at her child. The pragmatic, prim mistress that my mother had always been was gone. She was flighty and distracted. My grandmother had nothing left to say to her.
They're foreign cigarettes, my mother said. Let's go find them.
And in the fading light, my grandmother stared, flabbergasted, as my mother began to follow the scent to its source. I'm heading back, my grandmother said. But my mother kept walking. She found the source of the smoke soon enough. It was Ruwana Singh, standing behind a tall fir tree in her backyard.
Hello,
my mother said. Ruwana didn't start as I thought she would. Her calmness had become something practiced. She could make a breath last through the most startling event, whether it was her son being accused of murder by the police or her husband running their dinner party as if it were an academic committee meeting. She had told Ray he could go upstairs, and then she had disappeared out the back door and not been missed.
Mrs. Salmon,
Ruwana said, exhaling the heady smell of her cigarettes. In a rush of smoke and warmth, my mother met Ruwana's extended hand.
I'm so glad to see you.
Are you having a party? My mother asked.
My husband is having a party. I'm the hostess.
My mother smiled.
This is a weird place we both live,
Ruwana said. Their eyes met. My mother nodded her head. Back on the road somewhere was her own mother, but for right now she, like Ruwana, was on a quiet island off the mainland.
Do you have another cigarette?
Absolutely, Mrs. Salmon. Yes.
Ruwana fished into the pocket of her long black cardigan and held out the pack and her lighter.
Dunhill's, she said. I hope that's all right.
My mother lit her cigarette and handed the blue package with its gold foil back to Ruwana.
Abigail, she said as she exhaled. Please call me Abigail.
Up in his room, with his lights off, Ray could smell his mother's cigarettes, which she never accused him of pilfering, just as he never let on that he knew she had them. He heard voices downstairs, the loud sounds of his father and his colleagues speaking six different languages and laughing delightedly over the oh-so-American holiday to come. He didn't know that my mother was out on the lawn with his mother, or that I was watching him sit in his window and smell their sweet tobacco. Soon he would turn away from the window and switch on the small light by his bed to read. Mrs. McBride had told them to find a sonnet they'd like to write a paper on, but as he read the lines of those available to him in his Norton anthology, he kept drifting back to the moment he wished he could take back and do over again. If he had just kissed me on the scaffold, maybe everything would have turned out differently. Grandma Lynn kept on the course she had set with my mother, and eventually, there it was, the house they tried to forget while living two houses down.
Jack was right,
my grandmother thought. She could even feel it in the dark. The place radiated something malevolent. She shivered and began to hear the crickets and see the fireflies gathering in a swarm above his front flower beds. She thought suddenly that she would do nothing but sympathize with her daughter. Her child was living inside the middle of a ground zero, to which no affair on her own husband's part could offer her insight. She would tell my mother in the morning that the keys to the cabin would always be there for her if she needed them. That night, my mother had what she considered a wonderful dream. She dreamed of the country of India, where she had never been. There were orange traffic cones and beautiful lapis lazuli insects with mandibles of gold. A young girl was being led through the streets. She was taken to a pyre, where she was wound in a sheet and placed up on a platform built from sticks. The bright fire that consumed her brought my mother into that deep, light, dreamlike bliss. The girl was being burned alive. But first, there had been her body, clean and whole. Chapter 14. For a week, Lindsay cased my killer's house. She was doing exactly what he did to everyone else. She had agreed to train with the boys' soccer team all year in preparation for the challenge Mr. DeWitt and Samuel encouraged her to take on, qualifying to play in the all-male high school soccer league. And Samuel, to show his support, trained alongside her with no hope of qualifying for anything, he said, other than fastest guy in shorts. He could run, even if kicking and fielding and noticing a ball anywhere within his vicinity were all beyond him. And so, while they did laps around the neighborhood, each time Lindsay shot a look toward Mr. Harvey's house, Samuel was out in front, setting the pace for her, unaware of anything else. Inside the greenhouse, Mr. Harvey was looking out. He saw her watching, and he began to itch. It had been almost a year now, but the Salmons remained bent on crowding him. It had happened before in other towns and states. The family of a girl suspected him, but no one else did. He had perfected his patter to the police. A certain obsequious innocence peppered with wonder about their procedures or useless ideas that he presented as if they might help. Bringing up the Ellis boy with Fennerman had been a good stroke, and the lie that he was a widower always helped. He fashioned a wife out of whichever victim he'd recently been taking pleasure in his memory, and to flesh her out, there was always his mother. He left the house every day for an hour or two in the afternoon. He would pick up any supplies he needed and then drive out to Valley Forge Park and walk the paved roads and the unpaved trails and find himself suddenly surrounded by school tours at George Washington's log cabin or the Washington Memorial Chapel. This would buoy him up, these moments when the children were eager to see history, as if they might actually find a long silver hair from Washington's wig caught on the rough end of a log post. Occasionally, one of the tour guides or teachers would notice him standing there, unfamiliar, even if amiable, and he would be met with a questioning stare. He had 1,000 lines to give them. I used to bring my children here. This is where I met my wife. He knew to ground whatever he said in connection to some imagined family, and then the women would smile at him. Once, an attractive, heavy-set woman tried to engage him in conversation while the park guide told the children about the winter of 1776 and the Battle of the Clouds. He had used the story of widowhood and talked about a woman named Sophie Sacchetti, making her his now-deceased wife and true love. It had been like luscious food to this woman, and as he listened to her tell him about her cats and her brother, who had 3 children, whom she loved, he pictured her sitting on the chair in his basement, dead. After that, when he met a teacher's questioning glare, he would shyly back off and go somewhere else inside the park. He watched mothers with their children still in strollers walk briskly along the exposed paths. He saw teenagers who were cutting school, necking in the uncut fields or along the interior trails. And at the highest point of the park was a small wood beside which he sometimes parked. He would sit in his wagoneer and watch lonely men pull up beside him and get out of their cars. Men in suits on their lunch hour, or men in flannel and jeans would walk quickly into that wood. Sometimes they would cast a look back in his direction. An inquiry. If they were close enough, these men could see, through his windshield, what his victim saw. His wild and bottomless lust. On November 26th, 1974, Lindsay saw Mr. Harvey leaving the greenhouse, and she began to hang back from the pack of running boys. Later, she could claim that she had gotten her period, and all of them would hush up, even be satisfied that this was proof that Mr. DeWitt's unpopular plan, a girl at regionals, would never work out. I watched my sister and marveled. She was becoming everything all at once. A woman, a spy, a jock, the ostracized, one man alone. She walked, clutching her side in a false cramp, and waved the boys on when they turned to notice her. She kept walking with her hand on her waist until they turned the corner at the far end of the block. At the edge of Mr. Harvey's property was a row of tall, thick pines that had been left untrimmed for years. She sat down by one of them, still feigning exhaustion in case any neighbor was looking out. And then, when she felt the moment was right, she curled up in a ball and rolled in between two pines. She waited. The boys had one more lap. She watched them pass her and followed them with her eyes as they cut up through the vacant lot and back to the high school. She was alone. She calculated she had 45 minutes before our father would begin to wonder when she'd be home. The agreement had been that if she trained with the boys' soccer team, Samuel would escort her home and have her back by 5 o'clock. The clouds had hung heavy in the sky all day, and the late fall cold raised goosebumps along her legs and arms. The team runs always warmed her, but when she reached the locker room where she shared the showers with the field hockey team, she would begin to shiver until the hot water hit her body. But on the lawn of the green house, her goosebumps were also from fear. When the boys cut up the path, she scrambled over to the basement window at the side of Mr. Harvey's house. She had already thought of a story, if she was caught. She was chasing a kitten that she'd seen dart in between the pine trees. She would say it was gray, that it was fast, that it had run toward Mr. Harvey's house and she'd followed it without thinking. She could see inside to the basement, where it was dark. She tried the window, but the latch lock was pushed in. She would have to break the glass. Her mind racing, she worried about the noise, but she was too far along to stop now. She thought of my father at home, ever mindful of the clock near his chair, and took her sweatshirt off and balled it around her feet. Sitting down, she braced her body with her arms and then kicked once, twice, three times with both feet until the window smashed, a muffled cracking. Carefully, she lowered herself down, searching the wall for a foothold, but having to jump the final few feet onto the broken glass and concrete. The room appeared tidy and swept, different from our own basement, where heaps of holiday-marked boxes, Easter eggs and green grass, Christmas star ornaments, never made it back on the shelves my father had built. The cold air from outside came in, and she felt the draft along her neck pushing her out of the shimmering semicircle of shattered glass and into the rest of the room. She saw the easy chair and a little table beside it. She saw the large alarm clock with luminous numbers sitting on the metal shelving. I wanted to guide her eyes to the crawl space where she would find the bones of the animals, but I knew, too, that regardless of drawing a fly's eyes on graph paper and excelling that fall in Mr. Boat's biology class, she would imagine the bones were mine. For this,
I was glad she went nowhere near them. Despite my inability to appear or whisper, push or usher, Lindsay, all alone, felt something. Something charged the air in the cold, dank basement and made her cringe. She stood only a few feet from the open window, knowing that she would, no matter what, be walking farther in, and that she had to, no matter what, calm and focus herself to look for clues. But right then, for one moment, she thought of Samuel running ahead, having thought he would find her on his last lap, then running back toward the school, thinking he would find her outside, and then assuming, but with the first trace of a doubt, that she was showering, and so he too would be showering now, and then waiting for her before he did anything else. How long would he wait? As her eyes mounted the stairs to the first floor, before her feet followed, she wished that Samuel were there to climb down after her and trace her movements, erasing her solitude as he went, fitting into her limbs. But she hadn't told him on purpose, had told no one. What she was doing was beyond the pale. Criminal. And she knew it. If she thought about it later, she would say that she had needed air, and so that was what had gotten her up the stairs. Small flecks of white dust collected at the tips of her shoes as she mounted the stairs, but she didn't notice them. She twisted the knob of the basement door and reached the first floor. Only 5 minutes had passed. She had 40 left, or so she thought. There was still a bit of light seeping in through the closed blinds. As she stood, again hesitating, in this house identical to our own, she heard the thwack of the evening bulletin hit the stoop and the delivery boy ring the bell on his bike as he passed. My sister told herself that she was inside a series of rooms and spaces that, gone through methodically, might yield what she needed, provide her the trophy she could take home to our father, earning her freedom from me that way. Competition always, even between the living and the dead. She saw the flagstones in the hall, the same dark green and gray as ours, and imagined crawling after me when she was a baby and I was just learning to walk. Then she saw my toddler body running delightedly away from her and into the next room, and she remembered her own sense of reaching out, of taking her first steps as I teased her from the living room. But Mr. Harvey's house was much emptier than ours, and there were no rugs to lend warmth to the decor. Lindsay stepped from the flagstones onto the polished pine floors of what in our house was the living room. She made echoes up the open front hall, the sound of every movement reaching back for her. She couldn't stop the memories slamming into her. Everyone had a brutal report. Buckley riding piggyback on my shoulders down the stairs, our mother steadying me as Lindsay looked on, jealous that I could reach, with the silver star in my hands, the top of the Christmas tree. Me sliding down the banister and asking her to join, both of us begging the comics off our father after dinner, all of us running after Holiday as he barked and barked, and the countless exhausted smiles awkwardly dressing our faces for photos at birthdays and holidays and after school. Two sisters dressed identically in velvet or plaid or Easter yellows. We held baskets of bunnies and eggs. We had sunk in dye. Patent leather shoes with straps and hard buckles. Smiling hard as our mother tried to focus her camera, the photos always fuzzy, our eyes bright red spots. None of them, these artifacts left to my sister, would hold for posterity the moments before and the moments after, when we two girls played in the house or fought over toys, when we were sisters. Then she saw it. My back darting into the next room. Our dining room, the room that held his finished dollhouses. I was a child running just ahead of her. She hurried after me. She chased me through the downstairs rooms, and though she was training hard for soccer, When she returned to the front hall, she was unable to catch her breath. She grew dizzy. I thought of what my mother had always said about a boy at our bus stop who was twice as old as us but still in the second grade. He doesn't know his own strength, so you need to be careful around him. He liked to give bear hugs to anyone who was nice to him, and you could see this dopey love drop into his features and ignite his desire to touch. Before he was removed from regular school and sent somewhere else no one talked about, he had picked up a little girl named Daphne and squeezed her so hard that she fell into the road when he let go. I was pushing so hard on the in-between to get to Lindsay that I suddenly felt I might hurt her when I meant to help. My sister sat down on the wide steps at the bottom of the front hall and closed her eyes, focused on regaining her breath, on why she was in Mr. Harvey's house in the first place. She felt encased in something heavy, a fly trapped in a spider's funnel web, the thick silk binding up around her. She knew that our father had walked into the cornfield, possessed by something that was creeping into her now. She had wanted to bring back clues he could use as rungs to climb back to her on, to anchor him with facts, to ballast his sentences to Len. Instead, she saw herself falling after him into a bottomless pit. She had 20 minutes. Inside that house, my sister was the only living being. But she wasn't alone. And I wasn't her only company. The architecture of my murderer's life, the bodies of the girls he'd left behind, began to reveal itself to me now that my sister was in that house. I stood in heaven. I called their names. Jackie Mayer, Delaware, 1967, 13. A chair knocked over, its underside facing the room. Lying curled toward it, she wore a striped t-shirt and nothing else. Near her head, a small pool of blood. Flora Hernandez, Delaware, 1963, 8. He'd only wanted to touch her, but she screamed, a small girl for her age. Her left sock and shoe were found later, the body unrecovered. The bones lay in the earthen basement of an old apartment house. Leah Fox, Delaware, 1969, 12. On a slip-covered couch under a highway on-ramp, he killed her very quietly. He fell asleep on top of her, lulled by the sound of cars rushing above them. Not until 10 hours later, when a vagrant knocked on the small shack Mr. Harvey had built out of discarded doors, did he begin to pack himself and Leah Fox's body up. Sophie Sicchetti, Pennsylvania, 1960, 49. A landlady, she had divided her upstairs apartment into two by erecting a sheetrock wall. He liked the half-circle window this created, and the rent was cheap. But she talked too much about her son and insisted on reading him poems from a book of sonnets. He made love to her on her side of the divided room, smashed her skull in when she started to talk, and brought her body to the bank of a creek nearby. Lydia Johnson, 1960, 6. Bucks County, Pennsylvania. He dug an arched cave inside a hill near the quarry and waited. She was the youngest one. Wendy Richter, Connecticut, 1971, 13. She was waiting for her father outside a bar. He raped her in the bushes and then strangled her. That time, as he grew conscious, coming up out of the stupor that often clung on, he heard noises. He turned the dead girl's face toward his, and as the voices grew closer, he bit down on her ear.
"Sorry, man,"
he heard two drunk men say as they walked into the nearby bushes to take a leak. I saw now that town of floating graves, cold and whipped by winds, where the victims of murder went in the minds of the living. I could see his other victims as they occupied his house, those trace memories left behind before they fled this earth. But I let them go that day and went to my sister. Lindsay stood up the moment I focused back on her. Together, the two of us walked the stairs. She felt like the zombies in the movies Samuel and Hal loved. One foot in front of the other and staring blankly straight ahead. She reached what was my parents' bedroom in our house and found nothing. She circled the hallway upstairs. Nothing. Then she went into what had been my bedroom in our house and she found my killers. It was the least barren room in the house, and she did her best not to displace anything, to move her hand in between the sweaters stacked on the shelf, prepared to find anything in their warm insides. A knife, a gun, a Bic pen chewed on by Holiday. Nothing. But then, as she heard something but couldn't identify what it was, she turned toward the bed and saw the bedside table, and lying in the circle of light from a reading lamp left on, his sketchbook. She walked toward it and heard another sound, again not putting the sounds together. Car pulling up, car braking with a squeak, car door slamming shut. She turned the pages of the sketchbook and looked at the inky drawings of crossbeams and braces or turrets and buttresses. And she saw the measurements and notes, none of which meant anything to her. Then, as she flipped a final page, she thought she heard footsteps outside and very close. As Mr. Harvey turned the key in the lock of his front door, she saw the light pencil sketch on the page in front of her. It was a small drawing of stocks above a sunken hole, a detail off to the side of a shelf and how a chimney could draw out smoke from a fire. And the thing that sunk into her. In a spidery hand, he had written, Stolfus Cornfield. If it weren't for the articles in the paper after the discovery of my elbow, she wouldn't have known that the cornfield was owned by a man named Stolfus. Now she saw what I wanted her to know. I had died inside that hole. I had screamed and fought and lost. She ripped out the page. Mr. Harvey was in the kitchen making something to eat. The liverwurst he favored, a bowl of sweet green grapes. He heard a board creak. He stiffened. He heard another, and his back rose and blossomed with sudden understanding. The grapes dropped on the floor to be crushed by his left foot, while my sister in the room above sprang to the aluminum blinds and unlocked the stubborn window. Mr. Harvey mounted the stairs two at a time, and my sister smashed out the screen, scrambling onto the porch roof and rolling down it as he gained the upstairs hall and came barreling toward her. The gutter broke when her body tipped past it. As he reached his bedroom, she fell into the bushes and brambles and muck. But she wasn't hurt. Gloriously not hurt. Gloriously young. She stood up as he reached the window to climb out, but he stopped. He saw her running toward the elderberry. The silk screen number on her back screamed out at him, 5-5-5. Lindsay Salmon in her soccer shirt. Samuel was sitting with my parents and Grandma Lynn when Lindsay reached the house.
Oh my God,
my mother said, the first to see her through the small square windows that lined either side of our front door. And by the time my mother opened it, Samuel had rushed to fill the space, and she walked, without looking at my mother or even my father hobbling forward, right into Samuel's arms.
My God, my God, my God,
my mother said as she took in the dirt and the cuts. My grandmother came to stand beside her. Samuel put his hand on my sister's head and smoothed her hair back. Where have you been? But Lindsay turned to our father, lessened so now, smaller, weaker than this child who raged.
How alive she was consumed me whole that day.
Daddy?
Yes, sweetheart.
I did it. I broke into his house.
She was shaking slightly and trying not to cry. My mother balked.
You what?
But my sister didn't look at her. Not once.
I brought you this. I think it might be important.
She had kept the drawing in her hand, crumpled tightly into a ball. It had made her landing harder, but she had come away anyway. A phrase my father had read that day appeared in his mind now. He spoke it aloud as he looked into Lindsay's eyes.
There is no condition one adjusts to so quickly as a state of war.
Lindsay handed him the drawing.
I'm going to pick up Buckley, my mother said.
Don't you even want to look at this, Mom?
I don't know what to say. Your grandmother is here. I have shopping to do, a bird to cook. No one seems to realize that we have a family. We have a family and a son, and I'm going.
Grandma Lynn walked my mother to the back door, but didn't try to stop her. My mother gone, my sister reached her hand out to Samuel. My father saw what Lindsay did in Mr. Harvey's spidery hand, the possible blueprint of my grave. He looked up.
Do you believe me now?
He asked Lindsay.
Yes, Daddy.
My father, so grateful, had a call to make.
Dad,
she said.
Yes.
I think he saw me.
I could never have imagined a blessing greater to me than the physical safety of my sister that day. As I walked back from the gazebo, I shivered with the fear that had held me. The possibility of her loss on Earth, not just to my father, my mother, Buckley, and Samuel, but selfishly, the loss of her on Earth to me. Franny walked toward me from the cafeteria. I barely raised my head.
Susie, she said, I have something to tell you.
She drew me under one of the old-fashioned lampposts and then out of the light. She handed me a piece of paper folded into four. When you feel stronger, look at it and go there. 2 days later, Franny's map led me to a field that I had always walked by, but which, though beautiful, I'd left unexplored. The drawing had a dotted line to indicate a path. Searching nervously, I looked for an indentation in the rows and rows of wheat. Just ahead, I saw it, and as I began to walk between the rows, the paper dissolved in my hand. I could see an old and beautiful olive tree just up ahead. The sun was high, and in front of the olive tree was a clearing. I waited only a moment until I saw the wheat on the other side begin to pulse with the arrival of someone who didn't crest the stalks. She was small for her age, as she had been on Earth, and she wore a calico dress that was frayed at the hem and the cuffs. She paused, and we stared at each other. "I come here almost every day," she said. I like to listen to the sounds. All around us, I realized, the wheat was rustling as it moved against itself in the wind. Do you know Franny? I asked. The little girl nodded solemnly. She gave me a map to this place.
Then you must be ready, she said.
But she was in her heaven, too, and that called for twirling and making her skirt fly out in a circle. I sat on the ground under the tree and watched her. When she was done, she came toward me and breathlessly sat herself down.
I was Flora Hernandez, she said. What was your name?
I told her, and then I began to cry with comfort, to know another girl he had killed.
The others will be here soon, she said.
And as Flora twirled,
Other girls and women came through the field in all directions. Our heartache poured into one another like water from cup to cup. Each time I told my story, I lost a bit, the smallest drop of pain. It was that day that I knew I wanted to tell the story of my family. Because horror on Earth is real, and it is every day. It's like a flower, or like the sun. It can't be contained. Chapter 15. At first, no one stopped them, and it was something his mother enjoyed so much. The trill of her laughter when they ducked around the corner from whatever store and she uncovered and presented the pilfered item to him, that George Harvey joined in her laughter, and spying an opportunity, would hug her while she was occupied with her newest prize. It was a relief for both of them, getting away from his father for the afternoon and driving into the nearby town to get food or other supplies. They were scavengers at best, and made their money by collecting scrap metal and old bottles, and hauling them into town on the back of the elder Harvey's ancient flatbed truck. When his mother and he were caught for the first time, the two of them were treated graciously by the woman at the cash register. "If you can pay for it, do. If you can't, leave it on the counter as good as new," she said brightly, and winked at the 8-year-old George Harvey. His mother took the small glass bottle of aspirin out of her pocket and placed it sheepishly on the counter. Her face sank.
"No better than the child," his father often reprimanded her.
Getting caught became another moment in his life that brought fear, that sick feeling curling into his stomach like eggs being folded into a bowl, and he could tell by the closed faces and hard eyes when the person walking down the aisle toward them was a store employee who had seen a woman stealing. And she began handing him the stolen items to hide on his body, and he did it because she wanted him to. If they got outside and away in the truck, she would smile and bang the steering wheel with the flat of her hand and call him her little accomplice. The cab would fill with her wild, unpredictable love, and for a little while, until it wore off and they spied something glinting on the side of the road that they would have to investigate for what his mother called its possibilities. He did feel free. Free and warm. He remembered the advice she gave him the first time they drove a stretch of road in Texas and saw a white wooden cross along the road. Around the base of it were clusters of fresh and dead flowers. His scavenger's eye had been drawn immediately by the colors.
"You have to be able to look past the dead," his mother said. "Sometimes there are good trinkets to take away from them."
Even then, he could sense they were doing something wrong. The two of them got out of the truck and went up to the cross, and his mother's eyes changed into the two black points that he was used to seeing when they were searching. She found a charm in the shape of an eye and one in the shape of a heart and held them out for George Harvey to see.
"Don't know what your father would make of them, but we can keep them. Just you and me."
She had a secret stash of things that she never showed his father.
"Do you want the eye or the heart?"
"The eye," he said.
"I think these roses are fresh enough to save. Nice for the truck."
That night they slept in the truck, unable to make the drive back to where his father was working a temporary job splitting and riving boards by hand. The two of them slept curled into each other as they did with some frequency, making the inside of the cab an awkward nest. His mother, like a dog worrying a blanket, moved around in her seat and fidgeted. George Harvey had realized after earlier struggles that it was best to go limp and let her move him as she wished. Until his mother was comfortable, no one slept. In the middle of the night, as he was dreaming about the soft insides of the palaces and picture books he'd seen in public libraries, someone banged on the roof, and George Harvey and his mother sat bolt upright. It was three men, looking through the windows in a way George Harvey recognized. It was the way his own father looked when he was drunk sometimes. It had a double effect.
The whole gaze was leveled at his mother, and simultaneously absented his son. He knew not to cry out.
"Stay quiet. They aren't here for you," she whispered to him.
He began to shiver underneath the old army blankets that covered them. One of the three men was standing in front of the truck. The other two were banging on either side of the truck's roof, laughing and lolling their tongues. His mother shook her head vehemently, but this only enraged them. The man blocking the truck started rocking his hips back and forth against the front end, which caused the other two men to laugh harder.
"I'm going to move slow," his mother whispered, "and pretend I'm getting out of the truck. I want you to reach forward and turn the keys in the ignition when I say so."
He knew he was being told something very important, that she needed him. Despite her practiced calm, he could hear the metal in her voice, the iron breaking up through fear now. She smiled at the men, and as they sent up whoops and their bodies relaxed, she used her elbow to knock the gear shift into place.
"Now," she said in a flat monotone, and George Harvey reached forward and turned the keys.
The truck came to life with its rumbling old engine. The faces of the men changed, fading from an acquisitive joy, and then, as she reversed back to a good degree, and they stared after her, uncertainty. She switched into drive and screamed, "On the floor," to her son. He could feel the bump of the man's body hitting the truck only a few feet from where he lay curled up inside. Then the body was pitched up onto the roof. It lay there for a second until his mother reversed again. He had had a moment of clarity about how life should be lived. Not as a child or as a woman. They were the two worst things to be. His heart had beat wildly as he watched Lindsay make for the elderberry hedge, but then immediately he had calmed. It was a skill his mother, not his father, had taught him. To take action only after calculating the worst possible outcome of each choice available. He saw the notebook disturbed and the missing page in his sketchbook. He checked the bag with the knife. He took the knife with him to the basement and dropped it down the square hole that was drilled through the foundation. From the metal shelving, he retrieved the group of charms that he kept from the women. He took the Pennsylvania Keystone charm from my bracelet and held it in his hand. Good luck. The others he spread out on his white handkerchief, and then he brought the four ends together to form a small hobo sack. He put his hand inside the hole under the foundation and got down on the floor on his stomach to push his arm in all the way to the shoulder. He groped, feeling with the free fingers of his hand as the other held the hobo sack, until he found a rusty jut of a metal support over which the workmen had poured the cement. He hung his trophy bag there, and then withdrew his arm and stood. The book of sonnets he had buried earlier that summer in the woods of Valley Forge Park, shedding evidence slowly, as he always did. Now, he had to hope, not too slowly. 5 minutes at the most had gone by. That could be accounted for by shock and anger. By checking what everyone else thought to be valuables, his cufflinks, his cash, his tools. But he knew no more time than that could be overlooked. He had to call the police. He worked himself up. He paced briefly, drew his breath in and out rapidly, and when the operator answered, he set his voice on edge.
"My home has been broken into. I need the police," he said.
Scripting the opening of his version of the story, as inside he calculated how quickly he could leave and what he could carry with him. When my father called the station, he requested Len Fennerman, but Fennerman couldn't be located. My father was informed that two uniforms had already been sent out to investigate. What they found when Mr. Harvey answered his door was a man who was tearfully upset and who, in every aspect, save a certain repellent quality that the officers attributed to the sight of a man allowing himself to cry, seemed to be responding rationally to the reported events.
Even though the information about the drawing Lindsay had taken had come in over the radio, the officers were more impressed by Mr. Harvey's readily volunteering to have his home searched. He also seemed sincere in his sympathy for the Salmon family. The officers grew uncomfortable. They searched the house perfunctorily and found nothing except both the evidence of what they took to be extreme loneliness and a room full of beautiful dollhouses on the second floor, where they switched topics and asked him how long he had been building them. They noticed, they said later, an immediate and friendly change in his demeanor. He went into his bedroom and got the sketchbook, not mentioning any stolen drawing. The police took note of his increasing warmth as he showed them the sketches for the dollhouses. They asked their next question delicately.
"Sir," an officer said, "we can take you down to the station for further questioning, and you do have the right to have a lawyer present, but—"
Mr. Harvey interrupted him.
"I would be happy to answer anything here. I am the wronged party, though I have no wish to press charges against that poor girl." "The young woman that broke in," the other officer began, "she did take something. It was a drawing of the cornfield and a sort of structure in it."
The way it hit Harvey, the officers would tell Detective Fennerman, was all at once and very convincing. He had an explanation that fit so perfectly. They didn't see him as a flight risk, largely because they didn't see him first and foremost as a murderer.
"Oh, the poor girl," he said.
He placed his fingers to his pursed lips. He turned to his sketchbook and flipped through it until he came to a drawing that was very much like the one Lindsay had taken.
"There. It was a drawing similar to this one, correct?"
The officers, now audience, nodded.
"I was trying to figure it out," Mr. Harvey confessed. "I admit the horror of it has obsessed me. I think everyone in the neighborhood has tried to think how they could have prevented it. Why they didn't hear something, see something. I mean, surely the girl screamed."
"Now here," he said to the two men, pointing to his drawing with a pen.
"Forgive me, but I think in structures, and after hearing about how much blood there was in the cornfield and the churned up nature of that area where it was found, I decided that perhaps—"
He looked at them, checking their eyes. Both officers were following him. They wanted to follow him. They had had no leads, no body, no clues. Perhaps this strange man had a workable theory.
"Well, that the person who did it had built something underground, a hole. And then I confess I began to worry at it and detail it the way I do the dollhouses. And I gave it a chimney and a shelf and, well, that's just my habit."
He paused.
"I have a lot of time to myself."
"So, did it work out?"
one of the two officers asked.
"I always did think I had something there."
"Why didn't you call us?"
"I wasn't bringing back their daughter. When Detective Fennerman interviewed me, I mentioned how I suspected the Ellis boy, and I turned out to be dead wrong. I didn't want to meddle with any more of my amateur theories."
The officers apologized for the fact that the following day Detective Fennerman would be calling again, most likely wanting to go over the same material. See the sketchbook, hear Mr. Harvey's assertions about the cornfield. All of this Mr. Harvey took as part of being a dutiful civilian, even if it had been he who was victimized. The officers documented my sister's path of break-in from the basement window and then out through the bedroom window. They discussed the damages, which Mr. Harvey said he would take care of out of pocket, stressing his awareness of the overwhelming grief the Salmon father had displayed several months ago and how it seemed to be infecting the poor girl's sister. I saw the chances of Mr. Harvey's capture diminish as I watched the end of my family as I had known it ignite.
After picking up Buckley from Nate's house, my mother stopped at a payphone outside the 7-Eleven on Route 30. She told Len to meet her at a loud and raucous store in the mall near the grocery store. He left immediately. As he pulled out of his driveway, the phone in his house was ringing, but he didn't hear it. He was inside the capsule of his car, thinking of my mother, of how wrong it all was, and then of how he couldn't say no to her for reasons he couldn't hold on to long enough to analyze or disclaim. My mother drove the short distance from the grocery store to the mall and led Buckley by the hand through the glass doors to a sunken circle where parents could leave their children to play while they shopped. Buckley was elated.
"The circle? Can I?" he said,
as he saw his peers jumping off the jungle gym and turning somersaults on the rubber-covered floor.
"Do you really want to, honey?" she asked him. "Please?" he said.
She phrased it as a motherly concession.
"All right," she said,
and he went off in the direction of a red metal slide.
"Be good," she called after him.
She had never allowed him to play there without her. She left his name with the monitor, who watched over the play circle and said that she would be shopping on the lower level near Wanamaker's. While Mr. Harvey was explaining his theory of my murder, my mother felt a hand brush across the back of her shoulders inside a trashy store called Spencer's. She turned with expectant relief, only to see Len Fennerman's back as he made his way out of the store. Passing glow-in-the-dark masks, black plastic eight balls, fuzzy troll keychains, and a large laughing skull, my mother followed after him. He didn't turn around. She kept following him, at first excited and then annoyed. In between footfalls, there was enough time to think, and she didn't want to think. Finally, she saw him unlock a white door that was set flush into the wall, which she had never noticed before. She could tell by the noises up ahead in the dark corridor that Len had brought her into the inner workings of the mall. The air filtration system, or the water pumping plant. She didn't care. In the darkness, she imagined herself to be within her own heart, and a vision of the enlarged drawing from her doctor's office entered her head, and simultaneously she saw my father, in his paper gown and black socks, perched on the edge of the examining table as the doctor had explained to them the dangers of congestive heart failure. Just as she was about to let go into grief, cry out, and stumble and fall into confusion, she came to the end of the corridor. It opened into a huge room 3 stories high that throbbed and buzzed, and throughout which there were tiny lights mounted higgledy-piggledy on metal tanks and drums. She paused and listened for any sound other than the deafening thrumming of air being sucked out of the mall and reconditioned to be pushed back in. Nothing. I saw Len before she did. Standing alone in the almost darkness, he watched her for a moment, locating the need in her eyes. He was sorry for my father, for my family, but he fell into those eyes. "I could drown in those eyes, Abigail," he wanted to say to her, but he knew that this wouldn't be allowed. My mother began to make out more and more shapes within the bright, interconnected jumble of metal, and for a moment I could feel the room begin to be enough for her, the foreign territory enough to soothe her. It was the feeling of being unreachable. If it hadn't been for Len's hand stretching out and grazing her fingers with the tips of his own, I might have kept her to myself there. The room could have remained simply a brief vacation from her life as Mrs. Salmon. But he did touch her, and she did turn. Still, she couldn't really look at him. He accepted this absence on her part. I swirled as I watched it, and held on to the bench in the gazebo, gulping air. She could never know, I thought, that while she was clutching Len's hair and he was reaching his hand around the small of her back,
bringing her in closer, that the man who had murdered me was escorting two officers out his front door. I felt the kisses as they came down my mother's neck and onto her chest, like the small light feet of mice, and like the flower petals falling that they were. Ruinous and marvelous all at once. They were whispers calling her away from me and from her family and from her grief. She followed with her body. While Len took her hand and brought her away from the wall into the tangle of pipes where the noise overhead added its chorus, Mr. Harvey began to pack his belongings. My brother met a small girl playing hula hoop in the circle. My sister and Samuel lay beside each other on her bed, fully dressed and nervous. My grandmother downed three shots in the empty dining room. My father watched the phone. My mother grabbed at Len's coat and shirt greedily, and he helped her. He watched as she tugged at her own clothes, pulling her sweater over her head, then her mother jumper and her turtleneck, until she was left in her underpants and camisole. He stared at her. Samuel kissed the back of my sister's neck. She smelled of soap and Bactine, and he wanted, even then, never to leave her. Len was about to say something. I could see my mother notice his lips just as they parted. She shut her eyes and commanded the world to shut up, screaming the words inside her skull. She opened her eyes again and looked at him. He was silent, his mouth set. She took her cotton camisole over the top of her head and stepped out of her underwear. My mother had my body as it would never become, but she had her own moonlit skin, her ocean eyes. She was hollow and lost and abandoned up. Mr. Harvey left his house for the final time, while my mother was granted her most temporal wish, to find a doorway out of her ruined heart in merciful adultery.
This ends Disc 6.